Welcome to the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, where you learn the best doubles strategies to improve your game and win more matches. I'm your host, Will Bocek. This podcast, my website, and my weekly newsletter all focus on the goal of better understanding the sport of doubles and helping players like you improve faster through actionable advice that you can use in your very next match. My goal is to provide the best doubles strategy resources in the world. And to do that, I study, analyze, and work with players at every level of the game, all the way up to the ATP and WTA tours. If you enjoy this podcast, I've created double strategy products that go even deeper if you want to take your doubles knowledge to the next level. At the end of this episode, I'll explain more about them, or if you want to learn more now, go to thetennistribe.com/products. Here's today's episode. Hey everyone, and happy new year. Today, you're going to hear the first episode of 2024 for the Doubles Only Tennis Podcast, and we're going to cover a topic that I'm very passionate about. So I had Ben Rothenberg on to discuss changes we'd like to see in professional doubles that can help make doubles more popular. If you're not familiar with Ben, he's one of the most prolific and influential tennis journalists of the last decade. He was a longtime writer for the New York Times. He's written for Slate, for Racquet. He's appeared on CNN and BBC and more as a tennis expert. And he hosts a podcast called the No Challenges Remaining podcast as well. And Ben's also releasing a new book that is coming out January 9th. So this episode was recorded back before Christmas in December. But I wanted to release this kind of with the timing of his new book, which is all about Naomi Osaka. It's entitled Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice. So whether you like Naomi, whether you dislike Naomi, what you're going to find in this book is she's a very complex individual with a very fascinating story that he covers on this podcast a little bit and obviously a lot more in depth in the book. So you can pre-order it now. If you want to check out the show notes, I'll link to it there. But the main topic that we talk about in this episode is changes to doubles to help it grow. I heard Ben on a podcast episode with Craig Shapiro, and at the end, Craig asked him what changes he'd like to see on the Pro Tour, and he said we need to do something different with doubles. So that kind of inspired me to reach out to him and discuss this in a lot more depth. So we cover the big problems we have with professional doubles right now, why it isn't on TV enough, why there's not enough marketing, why it's just not as popular as at least I think it should be. We discuss what we can learn from the Bryan brothers, why were they so successful in terms of just getting fans out to the courts, getting fans to watch doubles and watch them on TV, and what other doubles players can learn from them. We also talk about changes we'd like to see from the tour side. So this is one of those chicken or the egg problems, which I've mentioned in previous episodes and Ben talks about a little bit in this episode, which is on the tour side, if the tour marketed doubles more, then doubles would become more popular. But the tour doesn't want to show things on TV that aren't currently popular. So what needs to come first? Do the players need to brand themselves and market themselves and become popular and then the tour will want to show them? Or does the tour need to help market doubles better, show it on TV more, and then the players will become more popular? The answer is, of course, probably somewhere in between. And we talk about that from both different angles in this episode. So we talk about changes we'd like to see from ATP and WTA, as well as changes we'd like to see from some of the actual doubles players themselves in terms of marketing themselves better on social media, being more engaged with fans like the Bryan brothers did such a good job of, and a lot more. So we go over rule changes, we go over scheduling, tour formats, coverage on TV, specific players who are doing a good job now, and a lot more. So this is a really long conversation. We're going to cover again, Naomi's or Ben's new book on Naomi. And then for the most part, we talk about making doubles more popular. So this was a pretty long intro, but it's a pretty long conversation and it's very wide ranging. And I think you'll enjoy this a lot. I will get back to strategy focused episodes next week. So stay tuned for that. But for now, enjoy this conversation with Ben Rothenberg. Hey, everyone. Welcome to the show. Today, we have Ben Rothenberg on. Ben, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Will.
I appreciate you being here. And you are a new author of the book, Naomi Osaka, Her Journey to Finding Her Power and Her Voice. I wanted to start with that. And let's just start out selling some books here, getting some pre-orders in there. I'm not sure. I think this episode will go out in a week or two, so it will be still available for pre-order. But I wanted to start with, the book is 496 pages, so it's very in-depth. And I heard your podcast with Craig Shapiro recently, mm-hmm. and you said you had to cut a lot of material to get it down to 496 pages. So my first question for you, obviously you know this topic so well, why is the narrative right about Naomi Osaka and why is it wrong?
I actually have a copy of it here, so I'm curious. The 496 is a little bit high because it includes like the index and the notes at the end and stuff. So it's more like a really slim, svelte 454, where it actually where the actual text ends. So it's lightweight, just very easy read. Although I did actually, Craig said on that show, you may have heard that he said he read it very quickly. And that has been heartening to hear from a bunch of people because I was worried about it being long. And it is long, and it's a thick book for sure in terms of pages, especially with a nice, you know, relatively thick paper they use for printing it. The publisher.
It's a good size font too.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not like one of those like really tiny,
textbook
font books. Yeah, definitely not. So the question was, what did I cut? Sorry,
So why is the general narrative about Naomi, and then why is it wrong?
You know, I think that people have things right about her and things wrong. I think she's a complicated, interesting person who's figuring things out about herself as she grows, and she's still young and mm-hmm. evolving, and she's been doing a lot of that growing and evolving in the public eye. You know, a lot of that is because, and we can talk about this in the context of her doubles career if you want to, but that she had a very isolated childhood growing up. You know, that she was not really seeing or interacting with people outside of her own immediate family for the most part, for lots of days, you know, weeks, months in a row. Was maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but that was really her circle, was just her and her sister on court with their dad, and occasionally maybe another coach who they were working with, and then seeing their mom at home. And that was pretty much it. So there was the homeschooling was happening there. She stopped going to traditional school pretty young when they moved to Florida. So when she was probably around 8 or 9, and she had gone to a regular elementary school up in Long Island when she lived there. So yeah, once they got into Florida, anyway, that's sort of, anyway, so she's growing and evolving. And so I think people are sometimes more or less sympathetic to that, you know, and I think there's just certain things with Naomi, who's become this sort of remarkably polarizing person for a lot of people, where she becomes a sort of cultural, like Rorschach test, I think a lot of times where, you know, this happens, like the book, opens with the sort of first chapter is about the Indian Wells moment last year, where she had the heckler who really upset her, and she was trying to figure out how to deal with that, and sort of mm-hmm. the range of really strong reactions of both sympathy and of frustration or annoyance that she provokes for something that's really shouldn't be a big deal, like you know, an athlete, a performer getting annoyed by heckler. People just extrapolated it to say, you know, all sorts of things about society and make their own takes and view it through whatever lens they had culturally, politically, whatever mm-hmm. it may be, generationally, certainly too. She's seen as definitely an avatar of Gen Z and how they're differently wired than previous generations for sure. So that's just sort of the broad stroke way of saying it. And then, yeah, I just felt like a lot of her story wasn't really told, you know, like we have the Williams sisters, who were obviously what the Osaka family based their tennis journey on, were so well documented from a young age, and their family and Richard Williams was interviewed extensively before the girls were on tour. And once they were, obviously, too, and a whole movie made about them and lots of documentaries about them. With Naomi, I really felt like, and I felt more as I dug into her story and did some research and reporting, there hadn't really been any sort of understanding of her origin story. And I do think it's really important for, despite all of the huge, loud volume, both in terms of noise and amount of conversation mm-hmm. around her as a pro and as a superstar athlete that she is, I didn't feel like there was the right sort of background and understanding. So hopefully this book paints a more complete picture that allows people to understand her, whether they choose to agree with her or not in the end about various things, or, you know,
sure.
appreciate or not appreciate or like or dislike, whatever it may be. At least it gives some, hopefully some illuminating context. And then also what she did also, I think, just reflects on a lot of issues that have been going on the last 2 years, you know, during the pandemic, activism, sort of even like, and there's a lot of mental health things tied to the pandemic that were fairly universal experiences for a lot of people that mirror what Naomi was going through at times in a much more high focus, high pressure environment of being a tennis star. But a lot of things mm-hmm. people in their own lives were having struggles with, I think that she, that's why she resonated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's something that I have to even like remind myself a lot, how young these athletes are and like
yeah.
how just because they're a certain way, like at 20 years old, doesn't mean they can't mature by the time they're 25 or 27 or 35, you know? So it's like I'm 34. And like, when I think about myself at 20, like I'm definitely a very different person, like with very different yeah. priorities, very different like opinions. And, you know, so yeah, it's interesting and I'm excited. I just got my copy yesterday and haven't had a chance to dive in other than check out some of the pictures in the middle that are mm-hmm, yeah. really easy to flip to. But I'm excited to dive in and learn more about her for sure. You talked about how Serena and Venus were so well documented. How did this book come to be? Is it an idea that you had or somebody else had and said, Ben's the guy for the project? Or talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I'd wanted to write a book for a while about something in tennis. I've been covering tennis, you know, pretty full time since like 2011, really, when I started working for the New York Times or contributing to them for the first time. Mm-hmm. And I had a few different ideas knocking around, and sort of feedback I was getting from publishers was they wanted something with a pretty clear protagonist and someone, you know, not just a sort of general look at the sport, kind of, which has been sort of my earlier ideas in a few different forms. And then Naomi, when it was, I really latched onto her as the possible focus of a book. Around 2020, when the pandemic resumption from the sport happened in New York, and she stopped play during sort of the peak, one of the peaks of the Black Lives Matter protests when they hit sports. You know, there were stoppages in NBA, and she pretty single-handedly led the tennis tournament, the Cincinnati tournament, as they called it, that was in New York that year, to stop for a day. And then she came back the next tournament and wore the mask with the seven names of the people on there to raise further awareness, and doing all that, all this activism, and then also simultaneously winning the tournament. And I was so struck by that because there's such a clear mantra and, you know, maxim in tennis and a lot of sports that you should avoid distractions and avoid, you know, politics or avoid activism or anything else. It's not being laser focused on just your job. And certainly that's something that a lot of tennis players take very much to heart in a lot of different ways, but that she was able to embrace and reach out to these other outside causes that didn't really have anything to do with tennis, and use them as motivation to drive her rather than having them weigh her down or distract her. I was really, really struck by it. And so that kind of sequence of the remarkable month or so she had in New York got me sort of thinking about her. And then I started doing more research and finding out what I could find about her early up, and what wasn't known, and finding what gaps were there. And there really, like I said, there wasn't much reporting of her in terms of in-depth reporting, really before the 2018 US Open was when the first bit started. And then even then, there wasn't a ton of sort of the going back and filling in the gaps of her early story the way that there might have been for other players. And part of that's just, you know, newspaper journalism isn't what it, and magazines and whatever else aren't what they were when back in the 90s when the Williamses were there. And, you know, reporters yeah. would get sent on in-depth, long-form story writing. If that kind of features been thinner in the newspaper world in Naomi's day. So there was an opportunity there, and hopefully people so far have found it illuminating what I was able to find. And I do think it makes everything about her adulthood that's been very well documented. A lot mm-hmm. of the public struggles she's had and triumphs she's had make them make more sense and put them in context.
Mm-hmm. So you took, so 2020, you took that idea and took it to the publisher and they were like, okay, yeah, this is, this works.
Yeah, it wasn't as immediate as that in terms of getting it like to buy in. It was more, I think I got the deal to do the book actually about a year later when after everything had happened with her in 2021, when she'd had the more public mental health struggles and pulled out the French Open and then also lit the torch at the Tokyo Olympics opening ceremony, the final cauldron there. Yeah, so there were some ups and downs with her, and I think, and that's when, just from timing and stuff too, that's when kind of the interest sort of bubbled up more. So I only was working on the book really intently from like fall 2021 onward.
Okay, got it. So I want to get back to that a little bit later, but let's share with us just your tennis story. Like, how did you get started writing in tennis? And I know you're in the DC area, which is a big tennis community. Yeah, share your story with the audience.
Yeah, I watched tennis on TV and in person at the what was then called the Legg Mason Tennis Classic. It's now the City Open in DC, which is pretty near where I grew up. It's less than 2 miles, less probably about a mile away from where I grew up on the other side of Rock Creek Park in DC. And would go and watched, you know, people like Michael Chang or Agassi in person there, and then became a big fan of tennis more from watching, I think, US Open mostly and Wimbledon on TV in sort of the later 90s. And with my dad would go up to the US Open a few times for like the Super Saturday, which I used to have there, which was the men's semis and women's final. Used to be all in the same, I don't know if they were the same session, the same ticket, but they were on the same day. And so we'd go up for that, I think, 3 years in a row. And the Williams sisters were one of the things that got me into tennis originally as a fan, or more intensely as a fan, seeing Venus and Serena emerge in the late 90s. And so they were in like three finals in a row, at least one of them. First one was Venus beating Davenport, and then two matches between the sisters against each other in the next 2 years, and this 2000 to 2002. And also saw like Leighton Hewitt breaking through there, Murat Safin, Pete Sampras was always in the mix there, and Agassi, at least I think just one of the years there too. So it was a pretty, it was a cool time, and I liked watching it. I played some tennis with my dad growing up just in sort of public parks, and then went to a couple like tennis day camps and stuff, and played on like my middle school and high school teams, but I was never that good a tennis player, and my main sport was always hockey. I was a hockey goalie. It was my main sport that I was actually like decent at, and yeah, tennis, I played a lot of doubles actually in school, which was in my school, which was the place they put the worst players. So it'd be like the four best players would go. I don't know what the four, I know formats vary around the country, but we played basically four singles and three doubles. So we would, I would be usually like two or three doubles, which was bad actually, because I was a complete, like as a kid, I was a complete junk baller and like was not built for doubles at all. And actually a couple times, finally, they put me at like four singles, where I was much more likely to do something because my game was just not built for the sort of, even in high school, the kind of like bang bangness you need. Like I was serving, you know, like my change up serves at like 60 miles per hour, whereas like my partner get killed in the net repeatedly. So it was, I was not cut out for doubles. But now I think as my game sort of, not that I play that often, but as my game sort of developed, I do think doubles would probably be a better fit for me.
Yeah, it is for most of us adults. So, yeah, so I mentioned the podcast with Craig Shapiro, which was a great episode. I'll link to it in the show notes for people listening. And at the end, he asked you what you would change about the tours. And you said, basically, doubles is not working. And there needs to be something that changes. And rather than just ask you to elaborate on that, I want to kind of tell you a story and then ask you a question that kind of comes out of that. And then we'll see where the conversation goes. I sent you a few kind of prompts yesterday and we'll probably jump around a bit. But in, I think it was 2022 Indian Wells, I'm sitting out in the courtyard area between all the stadiums with some friends having some lunch. And I look over my shoulder and Bruno Suarez is sitting there in the middle of the tennis garden having a beer. He had lost earlier that day. And he's just sitting there chatting with some friends. And if you looked over at him, you would have, if you didn't know who he was, you'd have no clue that he was in the tournament, right? He's won multiple Grand Slams. Nobody walked up and asked for his autograph. Nobody knew who he was. I walked up to him, got a picture with him, chatted with him, gave him one of my Watch More Doubles shirts. He could not have been nicer. He's a great guy. If that had been Stan Wawrinka, who has 3 Grand Slams, he would have been totally mobbed. Like, he wouldn't have had time to get in line to get a beer or do anything. Why is that the case?
You know, this is sort of the big existential question, I guess, of a lot of what you do, from what I know of what you do, and also, I guess, for this conversation, what I was saying. I think that doubles has had a really hard time on a global and sometimes even local level. First of all, I'll say it'll be different for Bruno in Brazil. Bruno, sure. I think what one of the things that doubles has done, it's been interesting a lot of times in certainly the last, like, let's say 10 years, especially on the men's tour, maybe 15 years even, a lot of the countries who had the most doubles success have had not much at all in singles. And so that talking about Brazil with Melo and Suarez, certainly the Indian guys, going back to, you know, Bhupati and Pays and through Bhopana and Qureshi even too from Pakistan, like, they no real single success from those countries. And the Colombians, certainly the Colombians, there was not major double success from there. So they become stars that fill a void. And even, I think, a lot of times the British doubles guys, because they haven't had the most single success outside of Andy Murray consistently for most of that time. So there was more appetite and appreciation for them. And some of the Japanese women you could throw in there too. There's a few different sort of groups of players who become bigger because there's a vacuum in their countries from doubles. So it would be different in Brazil. But the thing is, doubles has just had a really tough time. I think, honestly, outside of the Bryan brothers, in the time I've been covering the sport since, which is, again, full time on tour sort of since 2012-ish, the Bryans were around before this too, but the Bryans are really the only ones that I can think of who made themselves stars through doubles. You know, there are other players, and even some of the ones I mentioned, like Sonia Mirza or Lander Pace, both were pretty good singles players in their day and got a foothold there. Sort of like Martina Hingis, who was a big player. Who was around as a double specialist for a bunch of time I was covering the tour. She made her name through singles. And there's other examples of that as well. But it's something that just has not latched on for various reasons, but I just think that's the thing. I think doubles, and obviously you were in Indian Wells, you know the kind of crowds doubles can pull. And Indian Wells is kind of a unique case, and it's an interesting sort of wondering how, and I think we might talk about this in your outline I saw, like how replicable what Indian Wells does is for the rest of the tour, which I think is an interesting question. I've written articles about that before, I'm pretty sure, for the New York Times a few years ago. But for some reason, doubles is not where stars are made. And if doubles does really well when a single star comes, plays doubles. And then that's when doubles shines. It's when someone who has built a following in singles comes over to play doubles, and the fans of them from singles are really happy and excited to get to see more of this player they love. And they don't mind, or they're not put off by the fact that it's doubles. They just want to see, especially in person, you know, if you're going in Washington, we have this certainly. I haven't been going to that many tournaments this year, but like Ben Shelton, for example, is playing doubles. Yeah. And he's on a smaller court than his singles might be, and he's filling out the stands, and he's not even that big a name at this point, but he's someone who is a highly talked about player in 2023. And people are happy to see him there, and there's so many more examples of that. Washington's done a lot of sort of high profile pairings that they put Kyrgios and Tsitsipas together. They've had Murray playing doubles. They've had a lot of other things like that, which the tournament owner has been very intentional about, and giving some top stars more money to play doubles in their appearance contracts. Actually, it's been part of what he's been stipulating. So like Emiratu Kanu, even, for example, like played doubles in Washington, which I don't think she'd ever done before in her career. Yeah. But it was something that was like a line item in her contract for the tournament. And that's a great reward for the tournament. The tournament knows that they can put, you know, Raducanu on another court for another session for at least one match, maybe more. It's great value for their fans. They get to see this star up close and sort of doubles the odds that she's on court at any given time. So that part, I think, is where doubles have sort of shined. But the question, go back, I know I'm going far from this part, why Bruno Suarez is not pulling a crowd. Yeah, I just, for whatever reason, I don't think that doubles has had that singles. Tennis is interesting in that it's really, really good at making stars. And this is a whole sort of PTPA kind of argument. You go a lot of different ways with this. It's a very star-driven sport. you know, right. Even what I was just saying about like selling the book about just Naomi rather than like sort of a big composite tennis book. It's stars breakthrough. If you look at the highest paid like athletes in the world in terms of sponsorships, tennis players are very good at hitting some of the top spots. On there, like Federer was number one in terms of endorsements. Naomi very number one for women, but it's a very steep drop off after that. Mm-hmm. And just yeah, the sort of the rising tide doesn't float everybody individually. And mm-hmm. make stars out of even, you know, guys who are outside the top 20, let's say, reliably yeah. in singles. And certainly there are exceptions to that. But yeah, it the singles format does a really good job of making it so personal. And you spend so much time looking at a given player who is half the players on the court at all times. And you're seeing them up close with their thoughts, battling, trying to figure things out. And viewers become very attached to those players and those people and those personalities in mm-hmm. through singles tennis on TV. And I don't think that doubles doesn't have that same magnetism, I guess, so far in its characters, the way it's presented.
Yeah. Do you think, so you mentioned the stars is the big thing, right? And I've heard this, I've got Indian Wells behind me, and this was, this was from this year, and this was actually for doubles specialist on the court, and you can see how packed the stands are.
Yeah.
It doesn't always happen, but Indian Wells does a great job, which we talked about. But like you said, people want to go see tennis stars, right? So like I'm of the opinion that, and I've talked to people at tournaments about this, and they're just like, I just want to watch Coco golf. Some people even tell me, I like watching Coco and Jess play more than watching Coco play singles. I just want to watch her play. So they really just want to see stars more, possibly more than they want to see singles or doubles. They just want to see the star. So do you feel like, and the answer is probably some combination, but I feel like I try to break it down into like, is this a product problem or a marketing problem, right? And if we look at doubles, it gets, I'd love to see the percentages. I don't know. You'd probably have a much better idea than me, but like it probably gets less than 5% of the marketing dollars that the singles tour does. When I go to like the 2022 WTA finals was here in Fort Worth, 15 minutes from my house last year. Mm. And I walk around the stadium and see all these signs of all the singles players, and there's not any signs of the doubles players. And if you asked somebody with a ticket walking in, are you here to watch the singles or doubles? They might actually tell you, wait, there's doubles too. Like they don't even know that it exists. So how do you think about like it being a product problem versus a marketing problem? And then we'll go through some of these kind of suggestions that I've gotten from people over the years.
Sure. It's a chicken and egg thing, I think is largely it. I mean, it's sort of a cycle because, and this goes for things like in terms of posters, remember the debate I was hearing more recently than that. And certainly doubles players are not on posters. You're right. Almost always, unless it is something like a poster in Brazil and Bruno Suarez is their star. And so they put him on the poster for Rio, you know, the 500 or whatever other tournament it may be, where there's some actual clear pull. And that does happen in certain markets for sure, but not like a tour finals kind of thing, most likely. So, you know, I was even like, For Wimbledon, I remember there was this singles topic, but there was controversy over Wimbledon not putting Djokovic on their poster this year. And I don't know if you saw that, but there was sort of backlash from his fans, certainly, that they had like, I don't know, six players featured and some current, some past. It was all sort of looking at the past players they had. But Djokovic has won the tournament, I don't know, four times in a row before this year, roughly. And he's won it so much, and it's coming up in there, and was the number one, you know, going to be defending champion. He wasn't featured on the poster. And to me, that shows that Wimbledon, certainly something of Wimbledon's size and the, you know, huge entity they are, has done some level of market research that shows that Djokovic is not who's going to sell their most tickets or who is going to be the biggest pull. You know,
do you think that's what it is? Like, do you think they've done the market research for that?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think so. I think a lot of tennis organizations like aren't as capable as we give them credit for sometimes, but
I don't, you know better than that. I don't disagree with that general suspicion, which I think is totally fair and valid, but at the same time, like I'm using Wimbledon example, with Wimbledon, it's Wimbledon has their act together. I give them credit for that. And they get to focus on this one event a year, and they're a pretty robust organization with a lot of full-time employees and make a lot of money. And they would be able to do, and like Coco Gauff, for example, is on the poster in the UK when she was not number one either. And she was, you know, not British, and she was not a defending champion, not any of those things, not a Grand Slam champion even at this point, going before Wimbledon this year. But she was first, and this was this year's poster. But she was featured there, and that was their choice for whatever reasons they have for polling their ticket holders about who they like, who they don't like, whatever the advertisers, and that's how they come up with stuff. And so, yeah, they, you know, if in around the stadium or around the city of Fort Worth, let's say, you know, if they put, and it's different with the WTA right now because the WTA does not have a ton of superstars in its single side either. So it's a little bit different for WTA, but generally they would know at some point that putting insert name like Gabby Dabrowski's face on a poster would not, they don't think that's going to sell tickets, or that's not going to increase attraction to their event. And so that's their bottom line, is to get people in the stadium. And if that is, and this, you know, certainly in tennis, this is why it has not always been a correlation between merit, whatever you want to call that, and marketing, right? There's, those have been two separate categories. Most famously, probably in current tennis is, or recent tennis, has been Nick Kyrgios, right? Who's never been a top 10 player, never won a Grand Slam, never won a Masters 1000 singles title, or singles in Grand Slam, I guess he did win doubles in Australia. But he gets put on posters because they sense that he has the magnetism for possible viewers to come watch him play over someone higher ranked like a Rublev or whoever else it may be in the top 10 who's got a stronger resume for him. And is that frustrating for the Rublevs of the world? At times, for sure. But also, sometimes, also, those players recognize that Kyrgios, or and he's obviously a more controversial example that I needed to use, but even like Naomi at times, like Naomi circa 2022, for example, was not doing well in the rankings, was, and I, it was, you know, outside the top 20 for a lot of the year, but still was getting foregrounded and put on the main stadiums and put on the posters, because she was the one who was the name who was going to put butts in seats, the tournaments had calculated, over the likes of a, even Swiatek at number one at times. So that is the thinking there. And I think the doubles players, don't have the recognizability largely to be considered the poster children of the tournaments in literal sense. And what they could do to earn, to get that status is could being on the posters help them get the fame? Probably yes. Like on some level for sure. But that is seen as sort of being probably marketing money poorly spent to put someone on a poster who isn't going to short run deliver value from that showcase.
Yeah. I think I've kind of argued, and I like the chicken or egg analogy. I've used that in the past as well, because it is a thing of like, if they can't get on the posters, they're not going to be popular. And if they're not popular, they're not going to get on the posters. But one of the things that I've had discussions with several people on the podcast, including double specialists, coaches, and so on, is I do think it's something where, at least as the tour is like currently constructed, I think the doubles players are going to have to figure a lot of this out on their own and like make them create their own brand, which is something the Bryans did such a good job of, right?
Yeah.
Like they did a really nice job of that.
That's my sort of general take, is honestly the Bryans did so much and they were such a success. They had a lot of things going for them. They were very successful. They won all the time. That was huge. They were number one for long stretches of time and were winning majors and other big tournaments and so playing consistently. They obviously stuck together as a team very consistently for pretty much their whole careers, minus the, you know, Jack Sock interlude at one point for Mike. And they were so giving with their time and with fans and put on such a show. And I don't know if you ever, I'm not sure how much you're following tennis then, but like if you ever go to a Bryan Brothers match, for example, like they would be afterwards, they would take like the, they often put them on like last on courts in the scheduling. And they would often take like the bin of like used balls from the court that day and like sign as many as, like one would sign, and the other would hit to the crowd. And they would put like, you know, instead of the standard three balls, the Bryans would hit like 60 balls into the crowd.
Yeah.
And it's just sort of like huge over the top thing, but to make sure everyone had a good experience, everyone went home happy, everyone, you know, got to say they had a, the odds of having a Bryan ball, the tournament with a ball, the odds that it was a Bryan Brothers ball were very high. And they were naturally inclined to that kind of showmanship. And even with media too, they were super gregarious and chatty and engaged and happy to come into press after every match they played. Usually as a pair, sometimes one or the other, they get split up sometimes if did one-on-ones, and they would answer questions about whatever, you know. If you want to do a story at Wimbledon, for example, this is just making up something, but like on, you know, how the all white clothing rule was police, the Bryan brothers would be happy to, you know, spiel on that for 5 minutes, or something about how technology had changed rackets, whatever it might be. Like, it wasn't about all to be about them all the time. It was just, they were sort of game to do whatever and to be good sports about it. And they also were happy to talk about other people. You know, they'd been around the top of the sport for a long time and had insights on certainly their Davis Cup teammates, like, you know, Andy Roddick or James Blake or Marty Fish, Isner, whoever it might be. And also would talk about Federer and who they played in doubles and it all. They could kind of do it all, right? And they were super, and they just put in the work and were happy to go the extra mile. And that's a lot of what I have not seen, honestly. What I've heard from people kind of on the more organizational side, administrative side of the sport, is a lot of times with the doubles players, doubles specialists now, that same kind of hustle isn't there. That same kind of like going the extra mile and willing to, you know, showboat a bit or do something. And not everyone has a personality for it. The Bryans also had this unique personality where they were ready to be putting on a show and to be centers of attention and gregarious and outgoing and interacting with lots of people. But even just, you know, things like going to do suite visits, going with sort of VIP sponsors, going to do pro-ams, that kind of stuff. Like that's, and even doing their own sort of social media stuff. Like there were a couple, again, I don't know as much as probably shows about your tennis sort of background time, but you probably remember, I don't know if you know, but like in the sort of early tennis internet days, like circa 2006, 2007, 2008, 2009, there Dmitry Tursunov was on tour, and Dmitry did these like blogs that eventually got put on the ATP website, and he was became this this like kind of cult character. This is like pre-social media, largely, in terms of certainly pre-Twitter or anything. Yeah. And he became sort of the raconteur blog or whatever it was, and then did some vlogs later too. And like Andrei Petkovic did them later on. A few other players have kind of done. Tsitsipas actually did it, like sort of vlogging for a while. He did video style, but even just writing and stuff, like going this like extra mile to try to like bring you into their world and get you invested in getting you caring in them. And so someone like Tursunov, who was this fairly unremarkable Russian player, you know, sort of edge of between like ranked between like 25 and 50 for most of his good years on the tour, got this following because he had put in the, you know, he had the creative charisma and energy to do all this extra above and beyond stuff. And that's what I would love to see more of from the doubles players these days. And I know, again, it's not easy adding more of that onto the work of being a full-time athlete and trying to focus on competition, but I would like to see more attempts at creating their own stuff, being self-starters on some of the promotion too. And whether it's, you know, vlogs or social media posts, whatever they might be, to try to, and there, again, not everyone's going to have the personality for this, but I'm sure some of them do. And I would just like to see some of them step up and maybe we'll care, right? Because that's the thing about because if they're not getting the exposure through the main matches all the time, like just getting people to invest and care, I would like to see more of.
Yeah.
And I don't know of anybody who's doing that in doubles right now. There's a French guy, and I'm talking too much, sorry, but there's the French player named Jules Marie. I don't know if you know him. He's like ranked like 250, 260 or something right now. But he just, maybe 230, but he just got into Australian Open qualies, and he's like a vlogger. He does like documents all the time, going to all the challengers and probably some futures, whatever he's been playing. I actually haven't seen a ton of stuff, but he's bringing people on this ride and become sort of a cult figure with, I don't know, maybe about 100,000 YouTube followers or something like that. And he's brought them along and been a success through that. And just seeing someone do that in doubles, I'm sure that person, the personality is out there. I would just like to see that kind of self-starter rather than just waiting to get put on a poster and just waiting for someone to come, like bring people in, be revealing, be honest. You know, like I think like Ellen Perez maybe actually does this well.
She's pretty good on Twitter and Instagram.
She's kind of spicy occasionally on Twitter and Instagram, and that's what
she's funny.
That's what you kind of have to be, I think, to get people to notice you. And again, not everyone has that personality, and some people might get annoyed by by that kind of posting or that kind of attempts at being attention seeking, someone could negatively call it. But I think that doubles if you want attention, like just kind of being with showing up to your court at the appointed time, playing your match and clocking in and out that way. It's not,
well, you're not going to please everybody. I mean, if you're trying to get that level of popularity, it would be, I do remember, so I grew up in Memphis and we had a, I think it was a 500 event.
It was for a while. Yeah, it was 250 then a 500, or vice versa.
And the Bryans usually played in it and they always were at kids' day, you know, hanging out with the kids, playing tennis with them. And like you're talking about, it would be interesting to see, we'll never know, but like if they started their careers today with all of the social media and technology that we have, like where they would go with it over the next like 20 years.
Oh, they would, you know? Bryans would totally be like TikTokers. I
mean, they'd figure totally, it out. Yeah, they'd figure it out, but it'd be interesting to see how much more it would be amplified, like what they were able to do because of all of the ways you're able to engage with the players through technology and social media today. So I want to go through a few potential like changes to rules and format and scheduling that I sent over the other day. We talked about the Bryan brothers a lot. We talked about, you know, how people want to watch the Stars, and in my opinion, at least, I don't think they care if it's singles or doubles, but let's start with kind of format, big picture changes, rather than like specific rules. So on the podcast with Craig Shapiro, you said the tour needs to change something with doubles. Did you have anything specific in mind? Or like what, to rephrase that, what changes would you make?
I would just be much more thoughtful. I think that's what I was saying on Craig's show, as I remember, it's like sort of saying like a reckoning with it, right? Just like, I don't think doing the same thing is working. And, you know, and bluntly, like part of me thinks like either like really double down or just like cut it on some level, stop making the same product out there that it's just going nowhere, that just kind of filler. I know there is some incentive, especially with gambling, to have more content and people bet on doubles too, probably more than they watch it, honestly.
Interesting.
And so, that is for betting and for data rights and for streaming. And a lot of the reason that WTA was so good about having every court be streamed singles and doubles was for gambling interest. That was fueling a lot of that, because people are more likely to gamble on things that they can stream or watch. So that was some synergy that helped a lot of non-gambling tennis fans for sure, but a lot of that was gambling motivated originally, or gambling incentivized, or whatever it might be, by the tours. So that's a different conversation largely, but it is a factor for why things are going the way they are. But yeah, you know, I see the players. I mean, one thing is, again, this is sort of more on the negative, critical, less optimistic, solution-oriented side, or not saving doubles, rather. But I remember thinking during the pandemic, especially the 2021 Australian Open, when the players had to do the quarantine for a lot of them for 14 days in the hotel, and they were getting flown into Melbourne on like charter planes, and they were getting fed and getting all this like money and stuff. I remember thinking they are losing so much money by housing and feeding all these doubles players who are big in quantity. And it's one thing I would like to do a data dive at some point on, and see what percentage of the draws are doubles specialists compared to, 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. I haven't done that, but I would like to do that at some point to sort of map out, like, it does feel like it's getting to be more. I don't know if that's true or not. Certainly men's, because fewer top men are playing doubles consistently.
Yeah. The hard part with that is where you draw the line. Yeah, I've looked into this a little bit. I haven't like done the spreadsheet, but it's hard to draw the line, because it's like Katerina Siniakova is like 60-ish in the world. Sometimes she hits top 50.
I was thinking of doing it like, I actually thought about it. I was doing it a little bit last night, actually thinking about the show, and then realized like I don't have the time to actually do all this data and cross-pollinate these draws and stuff and these lists. But someone who is only in one draw, right? Let's just draw the line there. Like, so Siniakova is in the singles draw. She would not count for this purpose as a doubles doubles only player. Whereas someone like name someone
like Ellen Perez. Again.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Ellen Perez. Well, Ellen Perez has played some singles. Nebraska plays. There's some players who don't play any like
Ellen Perez is playing some mostly ITFs, and then she'll get into qualies for WTA. So it's like she's still pursuing a singles career a little bit, but it's certainly she's not playing singles week in and week out on the WTA schedule.
Yeah. So just but seeing more people around, and this has been an issue at tournaments. One of the things, and slightly an issue for journalists who are journalists, get first chop on this, like when the tournaments complain that like player lounges are getting too crowded and stuff. And part of that is because players have a lot more bigger entourages traveling with them now. And part of that, I think, has to be also that there are just more people who are tennis players who are in these draws, because there's fewer, more separate people, less overlap between the singles and doubles lists, puts more strain on the events organizationally. So that's something. But in terms of, I guess the question, I'm sorry, I feel like I lost track of what your actual first question was, but in terms of getting more stars to play doubles, is that basically what we're saying?
No, or? like what changes do you think need to be made? So it sounds like,
I think basically that, like, I'm I think you need like, to find a way to get more overlap between the two is to have more singles player. And this, again, this is a big thing I've seen in person at lots of tournaments. Indian Wells certainly too. Like Indian Wells, obviously, yes. Indian Wells and I think Wimbledon are two tournaments that really come to mind where it's such a big destination tournament that people are just happy to be there. And it's just like nice being there. And I'm looking at the picture of Indian Wells behind you, and you got the mountain and the blue sky, and it's beautiful. Yeah. And you want to sit outside and watch tennis, and people are less more open to doubles, maybe less picky, honestly, about what they're watching. And Wimbledon is the same way. Wimbledon, people are just happy to be at Wimbledon. It's like court one. There's lots of days when court one will be a doubles only ticket at Wimbledon. And it's just like a 12,000 seat stadium. And they'll sell out, you know, more than half of it, certainly for doubles only sessions, basically for like the sort of, I don't know what rounds it's probably like quarterfinals, semifinals of doubles, men's and women's, and some mixed. They'll do great because it's hard to get tickets to Wimbledon. People want to go to Wimbledon. And if you can get a ticket, even if it's for an off-peak kind of doubles-only session, people are like, yeah, sign me up. I want to be at Wimbledon for sure. And especially a lot of people who are, honestly, like I did an internship in London summer of 2008 when I was in college. And I was in the sort of group program. And one day, a bunch of people who were not really tennis fans went to Wimbledon because it was like a thing to do when in Rome or when in London. And they got tickets, I think, to one of those court one sessions and saw like two doubles quarterfinals or something, two men's doubles quarterfinals. And because they didn't really care about seeing stars, they weren't invested in the top stars. You know, I don't know if they could tell you honestly, like who Roger Federer was at that time, even though he was like the best player. Honestly, that level of casual or not caring about tennis, they were thrilled. They got to see doubles. They got to see Wimbledon, and doubles was plenty enough for them. They weren't picky about it. They were like, this was cool. We saw this two quarterfinals, and I don't know who the Bryans or whoever else, the, you know, Bjorkman, whoever else the players might have been in the doubles draw that year. That was great for them. And so, so when the tournaments are the destination, more than the stars, which does happen, like I said, sometimes at Wimbledon, at Indian Wells, I think are the two that stand out the most for me, then any programming is hugely desired because any matches are great. And so people are just happy to be there and we'll watch the doubles for sure. How that translates beyond that, I do think you need to find ways to get singles players to play more and top singles players. And there's
different... By that, you really just mean like the stars, right?
It can be pretty low. I mean, like in terms of that can be a pretty generous line, honestly, even like more like top 20, top 50, even, you know, people names that you would know, you know, like I'm thinking of, like, I'm not looking at the rankings, but if you have like, I don't know, like a Davidovich Fokina, what he's probably ranked like 30-ish right now, I'm guessing, without looking, like if you put him on a court, he will have more name recognition than if he's on a court with three double specialists, he'll have more name recognition than those three other guys. And some fans of his, or at least who know his name, might stop by that court and give that match a chance, even if they wouldn't, if the fourth guy was a fourth double specialist instead of him. And I think just having that foothold in the established like cinematic universe of singles of players who are no names at all, having as much crossover as you can, I do think gets people watching. Right. And then I think it's up to the doubles players to do all the things I was saying before about self-promotion, marketing, making people care, making people invested in their stories to keep and putting on a show, you know, to engaging with the crowd during play to get people to care and get them coming back when the singles players aren't there, which often they aren't, you know, into the certain NBA Wells, like, especially most recent years, that they have not been making, you know, semifinals or finals. These singles guys who drop in to play.
No, yeah, they usually like
sometimes they
out.
Do, but not usually. Yeah,
they usually play like one match and back out. Yeah,
exactly. Which is frustrating. I'm sure it's frustrating for the doubles players too, to have them taking up spaces in the draw when they're not in it to win it. So that's sort of the easiest thing. And what they could, you know, they could make minimums. Honestly, there's if the ATP could make this rule saying you must play at least three, you know, doubles 1,000 draws if you're a top 20 player. That's just a rule. And so Djokovic or whoever else the top players were would have to go out there, or even to be part of, like, I don't know if you've seen this list that's going around that Oleg on Twitter made of, like, the bonus money this year from the ATP, which is big amounts of money in the bonus pool. And that's a whole different system. But you could make doubles participation one of the line items you have to fulfill to get your bonus. You know, like, that could be. So, and if a player doesn't want to do it and wants to opt out, like, okay, fine, but then you're going to miss out on a lot of money. And so much of it just comes down to money. I mean, honestly, tennis players are very money driven in what they're good, especially as top singles players, and what they choose to do and not do. And they're going to do it if it makes financial benefit for them to do it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of something we haven't talked a ton about is, like, location, how much location matters a lot as well. I do think that, and having talked to double specialists, you know, they say certain countries will draw a bigger crowd than others. So, like, Indian Wells does well. Everybody in California plays doubles. It's a lot of, like, older players who've, and a lot of them sitting in the stands, like, at this match behind me, and just talking to people, like, there were some people there that have been following Megdich and Pavic the last couple of years. And they were like, oh yeah, I love watching them play. And it's not a ton, but I feel like the location matters a lot as well. But let's go through some, like, actual changes potentially for the tour. Hopefully we can get the ATP and WTA to listen to this, and they'll take our advice, and we'll have fixed doubles. So I wanted to start with actually the Luke Jensen tennis ranking thing that you had some questions about in my notes. So I interviewed Luke a few years ago. This was actually at World Team Tennis, which is a great doubles event, actually.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time. I watched a lot of World Team Tennis, yeah.
Yeah, it's so much fun to watch, and I'm hoping they can bring it back. But he talked about how, I don't know if you had a chance to listen, but he talked about how, you know, Djokovic and Serena and Federer, like, none of them are the GOAT. It's really Navratilova, because she has like 59 majors or something, with when you add up all of her doubles majors. And he said if we were to make him the he called it the Grand Poobah of tennis, then he would get rid of singles and doubles rankings and do a tennis ranking where you are required to play 2 out of 3 events at the majors. You have equal prize money across the board and equal ranking points across the board. You get rid of best of 5 for singles. You played no ad, all this stuff. I know you may not agree with all of that, but are there some things that you like about that idea? And talk a little bit about some of those things and what you would take away from it.
Again, if the powers to be think that doubles is worth saving, that kind of radical thing is what would help. I mean, because this sort of letting it just go now is it's not getting better, basically. And so it does take some sort of radical rebenching. I think I responded when we were talking in our pre-show chat. I don't know the exact mechanisms of it. I've mentioned juniors, but juniors, ITF juniors just have one combined rankings for singles and doubles.
Okay.
And I don't know the exact formula of that. I could call Colette Lewis or somebody who would be able to explain it better, but they basically do have one ranking. It's a combined ranking for both, and it gets you into both draws, and it incentivizes juniors to play doubles, which most top juniors do play a lot of doubles at all the big tournaments too. And almost every junior will play singles and doubles in their careers, which is great. I think for development of young players, I think doubles is always a good idea. And I think Coco still is kind of in that mindset, honestly, with how much doubles she's played, even though she's kind of not a veteran yet, but she's been on tour for several years at this point.
Yeah,
I think she certainly started playing doubles a lot because it was a great way to get reps and practice on big match courts and big match points and all those things. So something like that could happen if you require. I've seen people say versions of this too, where you would make the doubles players have to play singles too. like just, you know, put them out there and see what they can do, if they can or can't do it. Like, make them take up spaces in singles draws to that's an idea. I don't know if that makes any sense at all, especially because a lot of them just would not hack it out there bluntly. And a lot of them are not in the conditioning and age. And a lot of the doubles specialists are much older than the upper limits of the singles range. Lots of doubles players on the men's side who are, you know, around 40 or a little north of 40 as well. Mm-hmm. So something like that could work potentially, but it would be a real radical revision of it. Like, one of the things that frustrates me most about doubles is the lack of showcasing of mixed doubles. I think mixed doubles is this huge gem that tennis has done a really bad job highlighting. And you know, I've covered, like, I went to Perth, which is middle of nowhere. It takes like an extra like 4 hours to get to Perth from the east coast of Australia and like Melbourne. It's on the west coast of Australia. Nothing else is around there. Yeah. And because for in 2019, when Federer was going to play Serena in mixed doubles in Hopman Cup, and it was this once in a lifetime kind of thing of these, you know, at that point, the two leaders in pro era Grand Slam titles on the same court with each other, playing against each other, man and woman. It was this totally unique thing that was such a magical, cool moment. And then similarly, you know, I think later that year when Serena played with Andy Murray at Wimbledon, that was also great to see these two icons of their respective tours getting to be together. And that those matches got put on center court, their doubles matches, you know, those were big ticket moments for doubles. And so, but the prize money in mixed is terrible. Like, it's like, it's like, it doesn't go up at all. It's like almost the same as it has ever been. And there's no ranking points for it too. One very basic thing I would do is I would have ranking points for mixed doubles. I think they could definitely do that. That would incentivize even doubles guys and women playing more mixed too. Like, equalize the prize money for that. Have more mixed available at tournaments like Indian Wells that are looking
for. Yeah, would you add it to some of the 1000s maybe?
Definitely. And certainly like Indian Wells, I maybe case by case. Because if you're doing all these things, especially as they're expanding to all of these mega masters, these like 96 draws for the masters, which I largely don't agree with. But if you're making them this long, like, you have players just hanging around, players probably will want something to do. You know, the players don't. And so doubles and mixed would benefit from these, and they actually will benefit from these longer events. And that's one of the things with, you know, Grand Slams being best of five. I think it's going to be forever prohibitive for men signing up for doubles at Grand Slam events. Men who give themselves any chance of doing anything in a singles draw are largely not going to play, unless it's like an unusual case, like Tsitsipas wants to play with his brother to get him in the draw, that kind of thing.
Sure.
But generally they're not signing up for extra work when they're having this best of five daunting thing on their schedule. Really long matches and uncertain times and scheduling and stuff. The other thing is also scheduling, if you're on doubles, can really kind of mess with your single scheduling when they put you on and give you less. You have to play earlier in the day a lot of times, get less rest sometimes, so it can be a whole mess for
That's why you see like a lot of the women playing both, but not as many of the men, right?
Definitely.
Like Coco and Jess are able to do it because they're 2 out of 3 in singles rather than 3 out of 5.
And the other thing is, in terms of why, I think one thing that doesn't get talked about as much for why it used to be a bigger thing, that you'd have someone like McEnroe, who played singles and doubles throughout pretty much his whole career and won a lot of slams and doubles, and the Williamses even too early on, back then there was less money in singles. The gap wasn't as big. And so, and now that people are making much more money in singles compared to doubles, the math doesn't work out. Again, players are ultimately very frequently kind of rational operators, just purely on the money level, right? So if the money doesn't check out to play doubles, they're not gonna do it. So some sort of rejiggering of that could help. But yeah, but in terms of what Jensen said, just to kind of sidebar on this, with Navratilova being, you know, the GOAT because she's won more doubles, I think that like tennis, and I say this as someone who's a tennis Hall of Fame voter, like, we've had a lot of double specialists on the ballot the last few years, and I have been dismayed that they haven't gotten in, like, a lot of them, like players with like multiple, like I think the most extreme one, like Daniel Nestor, was on the ballot this year and didn't get in. Which is,
I had him on the podcast earlier this year, and we talked a little bit about it. Yeah,
that's crazy to me, because like, what more could he have done? You know, like, he basically maxed out. He was the first guy in singles or doubles to win like all nine Masters events. You know, he was like before the Bryans did it, and then Djokovic did it eventually in singles. Like he won gold medal, he won a bunch of slams. Like he was number one. Like he did everything you can ever want to do in doubles, but for some reason the voters are not impressed. And I certainly voted for Nestor. And it was, and I think I voted yes, like I think all three times. I think I don't know if her time has run out, but like Lisa Raymond was on the ballot, I remember, for a bunch of years, and I voted for her. I would have voted yes for Cara Black, I think was on the ballot recently. These people who've like more than a handful of major doubles titles. Why are they? And I know Hall of Fame is a different kind of conversation, but I do think it matters for the sort of clout and respect these players aren't getting. Like, why? Like, what more could they do? Like, if you don't, if at that point, just don't include. If you're not going to have Daniel Nestor in the poll, right. And just like don't have any doubles players,
then none of them. Like,
no, yeah, just say you don't care about doubles.
Maybe just the Bryans, and that's it. Yeah, I remember just so looking at the
be honest about it.
Yeah, looking at the fan vote ballot. After chatting with Lisa Raymond, this was like a year or two ago. When she was on the ballot, and like all the line items were like the singles players, and it'd be like, you know, one grand slam or three grand slams. And then she was at like 12 or something. I was like, well, she has like four times as many grand slams as these other players. And she's on the ballot for the third time. So it's really weird.
Yeah. It's just one of those things. I guess people don't think that doubles only is enough to get you there. And this, you know, I think it's kind of a good, like Paye's got in, for example. And I wonder, like, how much of that, and I would vote for him for sure, results wise. I mean, he has this, if you're going to put doubles players in the hall at all, Paye's for sure makes sense. But he also did have like a singles bronze medal that he got in Atlanta, actually. And I wonder, like, if that showing some chops in singles is what made the difference for him over someone like Nestor. I have no idea. It doesn't necessarily make sense to me that that would be the difference maker. And it's kind of a relative footnote in the overarching career of someone like Leander Paye, who was such a doubles stalwart for so long, to this one sort of early one-off Olympic bronze. But I don't know, because the Nestor thing bothered me, just because it was like, what are we doing here if this is not enough? Like, what is the math that's not mathing here for these guys? And I'm and if there's some official formula, why is it so? It's whatever kind of subjective formula you would come up with, I would have to think Nestor would clear it. But for some reason, Nestor wasn't the Bryans. Nestor was not someone who honestly was known as being particularly good ambassador for the sport, or being gregarious or engaging on court or off. He was just kind of went about his thing, kind of kept his head down and won a lot, but was not really a fan favorite. And was not really a media darling, and was not someone who left a major impression in that kind of hearts and minds way in the sport. And so without that, I guess all the doubles winning in the world didn't do it for him. So that's that again, it's just interesting how that works out.
It kind of reminds me of the recent like college football playoff rule where Florida State was left out. It's like Florida State was left out, but they put him at five. So it was like with Florida State's second or third string quarterback, putting them at five was less respectful than going ahead and moving them down to like nine, because they definitely like should have been behind Georgia if they're taking into account that like second or third string quarterback, or you leave them in the top four. But to put them just outside,
it's dishonest. Yeah.
Kind of reminds me of that, because it's like, we're going to include you on the ballot, but you have no shot of getting in.
Exactly.
Like,
and Georgia, well, and Florida State, just leave Florida me State's off. A good example. Like, Florida State's a good example because like they went undefeated.
Yeah.
Like, what more could they have done? Like, I understand that, yes, there's this, the quarterback. I went to Michigan, so I've more invested in, they obviously had a wild year in college football this year. But, like, what more could they do? Like, you did everything you could. Like, Nestor did everything he possibly could as a doubles player, and it wasn't enough.
Yeah. But it's like, don't even include me on the ballot if you're not going to, like, respect the.
So I think that's something that's, it's interesting. So
I want to run a few of these other ideas by you, and feel free to just latch onto any of them and prioritize them however you want. So the idea of getting rid of changeovers for doubles, only have a changeover between sets.
Like only change sides of the court even? Or like sit down, you mean? Like a break.
To sit down to break.
Okay. But you would walk across and change sides every two games.
Yeah. You can still do that. Yeah. That's
Speeding things up, like, basically, right? That's the point of that.
Yeah, that's one to speed things up.
I think this is in your, it's related, but I think it's on your items too, like no waiting between games kind of thing. I think that's
a big fan one. So like fans that, who are
that's
waiting.
That's a big one to me.
Yeah.
That's one of my major biggest complaints about going to tennis in person, honestly.
That's awful.
Is having to wait two or sometimes three at the beginning of a set games to get into a match. I think it's so unbelievably fan unfriendly. Mm-hmm. Certainly in doubles, to the extent, yeah, the doubles has to, yeah, it should not be happening. Players can adjust. And yes, you can wait to like not move between like during a point. I think it's fine. But like you can kind of, most fans I think could, and also have it be maybe restricted to just areas that are directly in like the server or eye line or something. Yeah. Most of the, I've talked to players about this and they say most of the time it'd be like a fairly specific part of the stadium, if it's a stadium, where they would want actual movements to be restricted. But it's so unbelievably fan unfriendly to be spending money on a ticket and have to wait like often like 15 minutes to get into a court because it's not a changeover, and that's just, no other sport does that. That's really not great and very fan unfriendly. I would at the very least have fans be allowed to get to their seats in every game, not every two games or three games, make it every game at the very very least. But yeah, for certainly for doubles, it could be much more carnival kind of thing, like open gates, move around as much as you want, talk, do whatever you want. And doubles players should be cool with that. And most of them, yeah, you mentioned World Team Tennis, doubles players especially too, because they play most often on outer courts, like are used to having a little bit more hubbub around them and should not
the US
be too,
Open, there's
too,
people
too delicate
just,
about that. Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
like,
walking
and so,
all over
and all
sides.
Players honestly can be better at that too, and I think all singles players don't need to be such princesses about it.
Yeah, I agree.
I use that as a gender neutral princess, but they certainly the doubles players, yeah, I think that's a good idea. It's having to be more, just come in if you have any interest, please come on in. Unless it's like at capacity and for some reason, which is great,
yeah,
a problem to have. But come on in, have it be open, have it be come and go.
How about like music between points with like a PA system and all that stuff? World Team Tennis does that, and it makes it really high energy and a lot of fun. But
that would depend purely on like a noise pollution level if there are other matches nearby. Like if you're at any venue that has multiple courts going, that's tough. One thing actually I know happened was one of the Jensens actually. And the Jensens actually, good you mentioned Luke Jensen, because the Jensens were, I think, probably a lot of what the Bryans model themselves on. The Jensens really were brothers, obviously, and were not twins, but brothers. And they were big showmen and really were playing to the crowd and being kind of rowdy presences on court, and did a lot of that. There was one match I remember hearing about. It was one of the Jensens playing mixed. You can look this up if you want, listeners or yourself at some point. One of the Jensens was playing doubles at the US Open with Mary Pierce. I'm pretty sure it's Mary Pierce. Mm-hmm. And they mic'd them up for the match. Like it was an XO. Like they had like them mic'd up and had like their comments like going, I think, to the crowd, like over the PA, maybe on TV. I'm not sure what exactly it was, but there was something where they were mic'd up during a Grand Slam real match.
Yeah.
And it was kind of like jokey and fun, whatever. Rubbed some people the wrong way. It was like a kind of controversial, kind of like a weird, like what just happened here kind of moment. It certainly purists did not like this, but it was US Open trying, or knowing that Jensen was going to be, you know, putting on a show and was going to be a ham in front of the crowd. Yeah. and Mary Pierce was game for it too, I guess. And not that she was considered as much of a ham, but she had a lot of charisma in her own way too. But they did that. And so, yeah, why not? You know, other things too, we just don't think of in tennis, like doing mid-match interviews with players, like during changeovers. They tried that very briefly at the US Open, like I think it happened like one time. Pam Shriver went to talk to Coco Vandeweghe, I think it was.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Like on a changeover, and she was like, it happened once, but it was like, why not? Let's doubles could definitely deal with more of that kind of stuff. Doubles, I think, especially should be doing a lot of the kind of stuff that Next Gen has done. You know, Next Gen having like the headsets for the coaching interviews and whatever. Just let it be more of a petri dish for experimentation for a lot of things like that, for like mid-match interviews, like miking up players. Make it more of a show, because I do think that like having it be staid and kind of a bit cold and standoffish Mm-hmm. Especially because doubles players, they have this partner on court, right? So they direct a lot of their emotion and interaction to that other person, and it doesn't go out in the world. You know, like you watch Rublev in singles, and it's like this whole emotional melodrama every time. Yeah. But if he's in doubles, it's he's doing less of that, I imagine, and it's going to his partner. Or anyway, doubles players are less obviously mentally compelling, honestly, to use lack of a better word. There's a book that came out. I don't know if you know about this. The book came out called, it was a novel, I think. It was called Doubles. It's like a tennis book, but it's called Doubles.
Okay.
And this came out maybe 8 years ago or so.
Okay.
And they were sort of saying that,
know about this, but
no, yeah, I can look it up. But it was like I think it's like a romance. Not, I'm not exactly sure what it is. But I didn't read it, but I know it. I remember like an article about it at one point, or like a editorial column that the author of it wrote for the New York Times or something.
Yeah.
At some point, anyway, I think it was a woman. She was saying that like doubles is actually more like real life. That it's, you know, dealing with like someone disappointing you or trying to rely on someone else and not completely controlling your own destiny out there, and it's like. Part of the reason she was saying she thinks people don't resonate with it as much as singles is it's not like as escapist. It's like too real. It's like seeing people out there negotiating and going through relationship up and downs and stuff, whereas singles is kind of more a fantasy of controlling your own destiny and being able to do whatever you want and live out loud. And that's not how the world actually works. And the doubles is like almost like too real. It was kind of a
deep
funny
psychology
funny
there.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that is. So I feel like it sounds like what you're saying, and I'm in agreement with, is one of the problems is obviously we can't like maintain the status quo because do you know a lot about the financials? Like doubles is definitely costing the tours money right now.
Has to be my thought. I mean, like this is, and it's something certainly tournament owners and directors will talk about. Because the thing is, like, doubles players and people, some people use very, you know, harsh language for this too, honestly, in terms of them being, you know, like leeches or something on the sport, which is harsh.
Had some comments last year about
Opelka. A lot of people agree with Opelka bluntly in the sport, not as online, you know, spicy as he is, but certainly, but people say like the doubles players. Certainly for tournament organizers, they, you know, get transport, you know, which costs money and time and organization from all the hotel space they take up, the food they take up, balls, practice court time, all these things. They incur all of this, you know, cost and resources for the tournament to manage them and to provide for them and facilitate them. But then they're not delivering on the revenue side and the audience side. And then they're not, you know, often seen as being even given the effort. And bluntly, there's also a lot of singles players who look down on the doubles players just on an athletic level and say, like, whenever we try, we can beat these guys and they're not that good. That is a sentiment that exists that I hear from top 100 singles players sometimes.
It happens on occasion for sure, but it's, it happens both ways. I mean, they lose.
I would like to see, you know, to send doubles players who are listening, I would just love to see some of them, take more initiative to make people care, to like to tussle and to build a brand for themselves that is gregarious and engaging and open and just kind of going that extra mile that the Bryans and the Jensens did. Like, I think, and you can do that as an individual or as a pair. And like, I think you mentioned in your outline and certainly people talk about too, it is a marketing. We mentioned the Bryans and the Jensens because they're siblings, and the Williams sisters too also were a hugely popular doubles team as a unit, and they're siblings too, and that's an obvious compelling unifying force in them as packages, as teams on court. And it's tough to, unless you, and you also have something like the Bubini and Pays or the Colombians, or you know,
Cabal and Farah was an interesting one because they were from the same country.
Exactly. So that's something unifying for them too.
Yeah. I'm curious if the tours could make some kind of rules around that, but I don't know. I mean, that's kind of tough.
Yeah. But I do think the doubles players also can just do more as individuals too. Like if you can, you know, there are some popular players like Luisa Stefani, I know, is like pop again, Brazil. Yeah. There's not until Haddad Maia showed up this year, there had not been really a glut of success in Brazilian singles tennis in a while. And so she will have more fans' attention and people will watch her wherever whoever she's paired with. And it doesn't really matter. Same thing happened with, certainly with Sonya Mirza. Indians would go watch Sonya Mirza no matter who her partner was. And like Martina Hingis talked about how great it was to have all these Indian fans watching her all the time because she was with Sonya. It was like a cool bonus. So, but yeah, I would just like to see these players be creative, do some sort of, whether it's blogging or vlogging or TikToking or whatever it might be. And I know it's like not part of the job. And a lot of people resent being told to do things that are not part of the job. But if you want to ensure that double, especially with all this, you know, talk of possible radical revampings of the tour in Saudi Arabia and stuff, if you want to show that's the kind of thing that could happen, you know, it's I haven't heard this, but like it would not shock me, for example, if the Saudis, let's say, bought, this is again extreme, but being talked about, the Saudis bought the tours and said, we're going to do tennis tours, we're going to be singles only.
Yeah.
Like, that's not out of the realm.
It's in the realm. Yeah, it is in the realm.
Yeah. And so, that should be a fire under their butts about that, is my basic thought on that. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I like the Petri dish analogy from earlier as well. I mean, I think on the player side, we've talked about that. Like, they've got to take it into their own hands and market themselves better. And some players are doing this and some just don't have the personalities for it, which is okay. But yeah, I mean, there's a number of players. It's always interesting when I reach out to ask them to come on the podcast. Like, I've had some people tell me to my face, like, oh, I don't do stuff like that. And they're a double specialist.
Which kills me. And this kills a lot of people in the sport too. Like, honestly, I've had, not to sound too egotistical about it, but like when I put in interview requests and I get no's from doubles players, which doesn't happen much, but does happen sometimes.
Yeah.
I'm often like, I'm baffled. This happens more and more lately too. It's more of a generational thing. Also, this current generation is worse about it than it was circa 10 years ago. And it's like, if you're shouting, watch more doubles, you know, but you're not actually putting in the work and the time and the hardship, I use in quotation fingers there, of talking to somebody for 15 minutes for an interview, you know, from somewhere like the New York Times that I was writing for before. Like, how do you think this works? You know, like, how do you think that if you're not going to save yourself, who's going to, you don't deserve to be saved on some level. If you're not going to take these obvious paths towards bettering your situation. And so that is a frustration that I've had for sure. And again, that's not super, I'm not going to name them. There are certain doubles players' reputation for being less helpful than others. And that's well known within the sport for a lot of people who's difficult or not. But yeah, I just think that, and a lot of doubles players should be, honestly, like, this is going to get harsh again, but like grateful to be there because if they are having this net negative revenue situation with the sport, like try your best to be a good citizen and to make people glad you're there.
Yeah.
Be positive for it.
It's probably not like a higher ratio necessarily than singles, but like you said, I think because doubles doesn't get the marketing dollars from the tour, like they need to make an effort to do it themselves. And a lot of the players are really good about it. Like Rajiv Ram, I've had on several times.
He's great.
He's great. Demi Schwarz is always super helpful.
She's, I adore Demi. Yeah.
Yeah. She's always, you know, Nicole Melichar Martinez has been helpful. Ellen Perez has been on a few times. Gabby Dabrowski helped me launch the Watch More Doubles t-shirts and has been a big advocate of doubles. So, it's definitely not the majority. And it may not be even a higher percentage than the singles players, but it should become more of kind of a thing where they take it into their own hands. And then the other side of this is the Petri dish analogy. Like you said, like the tours, I do think they can create some kind of like fun environment. Like the thing I picture is like at the US Open, you go and you have the singles tournament going on, the doubles tournament going on. But what if like court 17 was a doubles court for like a few of the days and there was music and it just felt like a totally different event.
Yeah.
I can imagine like somebody who's showing up to a tennis tournament for the first time going to that and then going to the singles and Ash and being like, that's so much more fun. Like they were playing music. I was allowed to talk between the points, like I'd go in and out and grab a beer whenever I wanted. I want to do more, watch more of the double stuff. Like if they could make some changes that would just separate itself from singles almost and take advantage of the things that singles is just so slow to move on. All the complaints about
You mentioned World in Tennis earlier, and that totally resonates for what you're saying. Like having it be more family friendly, more accessible, more fun, less stodgy, less taking itself so seriously, you know, and it also depends a lot on the local culture of the given tournament too. And tennis really does, one of the cool things about it, does reflect a lot of very different mindsets. Like being at Wimbledon versus being at the US Open is a totally different aesthetic and sensory experience on so many different levels. And you never have music blaring between points at Wimbledon, and that's fine. That's good. That's nice that you have these kind of varieties. But, but yeah, but it'd be nice to see something like doubles players. You know, like I loved seeing at the Next Gen. Finally, they had Next Gen in this year for the ATP guys, young guys. They had like a skills competition, which is something I've wanted forever for tennis to do. Something like All-Stars, whatever various sports, you know, baseball, Home Run Derby, NBA, NHL, all have these skills competitions they do around their All-Star weekends. And finally, tennis was doing something like that. Like, why not have the doubles guys go out there and or you make them do this? Like, if they're not going to do it themselves, like if they're not self-starters like we want them to be, we keep saying we wish they had this, you can kind of, this is something you can't do, is make them go out there and do challenges with fans. Like, can you return, you know, have them each go out and hit 20 serves and see, like, give, you know, fans a prize that they can return a Marcelo Melo serve or something, you know. Then it had to be a good server, like some, like Melo, but like some, anybody's ATP level service can be pretty tough for most fans to confront. So things like that, or go out and, you know, more sort of more autograph things, like more have them be out there and do stuff. And actually Indian Wells did, ATP did organize for a few years, a pro-am with media and doubles specialists, which was actually pretty, which was fun. Yeah, they did it like two or three times. They did it like, I did it, I think two or three times, and I played with that Mello actually, I think a couple times. And it was a nice it was cool just being on court, and obviously they could kill you if they wanted to at any point. But they were, you know, mostly taking it relatively easy with when hitting the ball at a media person, and media people are various ages and fitness levels and skill levels and stuff. And but it was a way to get to know them. And I definitely wrote an article for the Times, I remember, about that. But like, this was an example of doubles making the extra push of like going above and beyond a bit, of trying to engage with media, taking time out of their schedules to work. And it was something that they all, a lot of them said, like, we'd be open to doing more of this. Like, at least the mindset back then with that crew circa, probably 8-9 years ago at this point, was saying the right things about like, we can do this. This is something we can do. And to get you guys to care more about, they saw the benefit of seeing this like very international crew of sort of like top kind of level mainstream reporters, which again is a thinning crop in the sport in terms of newspapers and stuff like that. But they were up for it. And so just seeing more stuff like that, more kind of like meet and greet kind of things, like go, you know, have doubles players come in and talk to media, you know, kind of all access hour level things. Like I know you were in Cancun, you know, like, and often there's not much competition, obviously, where you were probably a lot of times the only person talking to doubles players, I have to imagine.
Most of the time we're the only company that'll request, and there was a few exceptions, like when the Czechs played, there was some Czech media there, and then Coco and Jessica is a little different. But yeah, for the specialists who are not, you know, inside the top 100 in singles, it's generally us, which is really nice for me. But I would love to
see a lot of times there are outlets who are more dynamic and more flexible and smaller, honestly, and sort of more upstart, you know, like various bloggers or whoever else might be credentialed sometimes to smaller tournaments, and just, you know, say like, hey, if you want a one-on-one this week, we will not be able to get you, you know, Iga or whoever else you might be requesting, or Coco Golf, but how about you get 15 minutes with Ellen Perez, and that's good for everybody, right? If you can make those kind of accommodations. And we'd love to see the tours be more proactive with that, and the doubles players also be just game for that. And it's not always comfortable to, you know, doing interviews about people, you know, that who might not be super experienced in the sport, honestly. Sometimes these upstart media people, I was certainly that way in my early days. I'm sure for you, it's been a learning curve too. For everybody, it is.
Yeah, I still feel like that sometimes.
And I still do too. So it, you know, it's something that takes a lot of practice to get better at. And I asked some really just like poorly worded questions early on. Asking one of the first ones to ever cover credentials, this is sidebar, but like, I was talking to Sam Stosur's Eastbourne. That was the same. I mentioned doing his internship in England. And so I went to Eastbourne. I was credentialed for Eastbourne. And Stosur had lost in Birmingham the week before to Katarina Bondarenko, who was like an unseeded player. And then Bondarenko went on to win the title in Birmingham, kind of surprisingly. She lost like first, second round to her. And my first question to Stosur was something along the lines of like, seeing Bondarenko win the title last year, did it make you feel less awful about that really bad loss last week or something? Just like something just like really poorly worded, something like that. She just kind of looked at me like, what, that's not how you do this. Like, but she did give a fine response in the end and was cool about it. But it was just sort of me having to learn, work, you know, make mistakes to learn what not to do, and just had on some basic level. And I was like only 20 or 21 at the time when this happened. Yeah, it was interesting. Just doing that kind of stuff. Yeah, but doubles players, you know, should be hungry and should not be saying no to almost anything at this point. Because if you're just there to go and clock in and clock out and cash whatever check it is, fine. Like that's certainly the way some people approach their jobs, but this particular job is entertainment industry and on a basic level. Tennis, pro tennis is entertainment. It's not merit. It's about putting on a show and getting butts in seats and getting people to want to watch you. And
yeah,
it's part of the gig. So if you say watch more doubles on your chest, if you have one of those shirts, you know, put your actions where your mouth is.
Yeah.
Where your shirt is. Or your cotton.
Yeah. I want to do at some point like a piece on kind of the financial side of doubles. Cause I mean, a lot of these players are going to have a second career as well, because the prize money is so low. So when they're thinking about like trying to market themselves better and get a big following, that's not only going to help you now, and it may not impact your prize money at all during your career, but if you know, if you do retire at 35 or 40 and quit playing doubles, you may not have enough money at that point to like totally retire, or at least as much as you'd like. So if you have built up that kind of reputation and following, it makes, you know, getting sponsorships more easy.
Yeah, look, I think the players have to be self starters and work on this and you know, work for this the same way they work on the rest of their careers, right? Put in the time, put in the effort. You won't always see immediate rewards. You might, you know, do an interview with a blog or a YouTuber or whatever it might be, which does not do big numbers and does not immediately get you a new sponsorship deal, but just like keep doing it and keep putting yourself out there and those things will. And don't trust that your, you know, agent or whoever, if you have, most doubles players do have agents, a lot of them do. But a lot of times they're honestly not the biggest client of their given agent. They're kind of low on the totem pole for whoever their agent or their agency might be more often than not in tennis. So, you know, back yourself and put yourself, make good on yourself there. And, you know, and some people will say like, that's not time well spent. My time is better spent in the gym, you know, resting, recuperating, eating right, whatever, kind of more on the practice court, whatever else it might be. And that will help. That's what's helped me get, you know, difference between a second round and a semifinal. And so that's not worth it to me. Then, okay, that's your calculus, but then don't complain if no one cares about you and your results.
Yeah. Well, I want to be respectful of your time. We've run pretty long here. And we got through a lot of stuff. I think, yeah, I don't know. I love these conversations because it really just gets me thinking about like what changes can be made. Not that I have the power to make them, but if I can just keep the conversation going for the next five plus years or whatever.
And that's what I was saying on Craig's show, which I think got you sort of, which made you invite me on here. It's like, it's just, I do think that there should be more thinking about it, right? The word I sort of use is reckoning, right? Like just, it's not, I don't think it's working. I don't think it's good enough right now. I don't think it's a positive for anybody involved in the sport or in doubles. I don't think anybody's sort of winning in this current status. And so some sort of admitting that, accepting that, and confronting that, and whatever, you know, whether that's having less doubles and being much more strategic about where you have it, like only at certain tournaments or only when you can really showcase it the way you want to, or what, something, I don't know. Because right now it's, I was saying this during, watching Next Gen, which doesn't have the doubles alleys, right? Which is just which looks really weird and off-putting when you first see it. But then I was thinking, like, I almost never am watching doubles on TV, honestly. So like, why are there always these lines on the court that aren't being used? And so if you're going to keep having doubles alleys on courts, make it worth have a purpose. So anyways, yeah. that was kind of a trigger for it. Thinking that way, but maybe not every tournament should have doubles. Maybe it should be more of a special thing or certain things, or, you know, mm-hmm. I would like to maybe try a tournament without doubles, which I know doubles players would be scared by if they started getting cut from events, mm-hmm. but just see how it went, and maybe given 250 or even a 500, see how crowds react to it, what the sort of sentiment is. And then from that, try to maybe back calculate like what doubles is bringing that's missing. Right. And then kind of figure out that way. And then, or yeah. even if you want to try to have a, there used to be doubles only events, used to be a bigger thing on tour back in like the 80s and 70s, 80s, 90s. There used to be a few doubles only tournaments. They used to have separate year-end championships for the doubles, a different time, a different venue. There's ways of doing it, but it's just everything's just very the same right now. So this kind of petri dish, just shake it up. If you care, if you think it's worth fighting for, if you think it's broken as it is, and I think people would be nodding along to at least some of those statements. Then it's worth taking some risks. I said about Davis Cup too. Like Davis Cup was not working previously. Mm-hmm. This big shakeup they had 4 or 5 years ago when they had the vote and changed it. So, and they can go back to the old way if you need to, but it's worth trying something new.
Yeah.
So something about doubles.
Yeah. So a couple of last questions and then we'll hop off here.
Sure.
What's your favorite double story that you've covered?
One of the early ones, I was thinking about this, one of the early ones that I remember doing, this is that back in like blogging days, even before I was working mm-hmm. the New York Times, I think, was when Bopana and Qureshi were together for the Indo-Pac Express. Mm-hmm. And that was something I'm not a part of the world geopolitically I was very familiar with at all, but the real tensions between India and Pakistan were there, and seeing mm-hmm. these two guys unite just purely because they thought they were good fits for each other in doubles. They were really only thinking about it from a doubles point of view, in terms of that their games aligning on court was largely their thinking. Not, they didn't want to make a statement per se, but their pairing up was really meaningful and became a story that was covered by, you know, political reporters who cover that part of the world and realized how remarkable this was, that there was this pairing, and like they made it to, you know, a deep US Open run. And I think like their ambassadors from their respective countries who would normally never like be in the same room as each other, that may be an exaggeration, but certainly we're not warm towards each other usually, but, like sitting next to each other at the US Open watching this thing. Mm-hmm. And that was a very unique, like, and those are again not guys who were big stars on their own rights before this really at all, either of them, but because of this sort of cultural moment they had, and mm-hmm. the sort of power that was sort of a uniquely sort of doubles story for me of seeing that. And then one of the other stories that comes to mind too is actually one of the first stories I ever like broke as a reporter was that Martina Hingis, this is while she was retired before she came back as a double specialist, she told me, and maybe she shouldn't have, she kind of loose lip, but I was at World Team Tennis actually and was interviewing her about mixed doubles getting added to the Olympics, this must have been like, I guess, 2011. And so mixed mm-hmm. doubles was getting added to the Olympics for 2012, which had not been an Olympic event previously. And I asked if she would ever come back to play with Federer now that it was an event and a possibility. And she told me that Federer had actually already asked her if she would come back out of retirement to come play doubles. And that was like such huge news as a blogger for SB Nation at the time that I got the scoop that like Federer was asking Hingis to come out of retirement and for doubles, but it was essentially doubles, mixed doubles story. Olympic doubles, the 2012 Olympics was amazing tournament kind of across the board, and the doubles there was really good too.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of my
we'll link to both of those.
Yeah,
we'll link to both of those.
There's some good stories too. I wrote about Krejcikova before she had her single success, really, about her mm-hmm. working with Novotna. I've profiled, you mentioned Demi Schurz. Again, adore Demi Schurz. Happy to get to sort of write about her and her unique profile she cuts on tour. And there's been some cool ones. Don't often get time. There does have to be, it's a higher bar to clear to get a double story ran for sure. But there are definitely some cool characters in there for sure.
Sure. What's your favorite tournament?
It depends. I think different tournaments, like I said, I think scratch very different, you know, itches in terms of what you like. My usual answer for just being on the grounds, although it did change, I got to say, this year I did not love it, was the US Open. The US Open was very overcrowded this year on the grounds. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you heard that from other people too, but, or if you were there,
I'm not sure,
but it was like, it wasn't that you couldn't get seats to go watch like the good matches. Like you couldn't get seats to watch the bad matches. There'd be like two kind of no name players playing an uncompetitive match and it was all full. It was just way too crowded. Mm-hmm. And they were setting attendance records all the time, but it was too much. And so,
yeah.
But generally, I like the US. I'm American. I like the loudness of it. I like the kind of openness of it, the more relaxed, the not shushing you kind of stuff at US Open. That all I like with all that.
I've kind of felt like I was there. I think I got there Wednesday and was there through like the following Tuesday or something. And I felt like that, like Wednesday, Thursday, maybe Friday, it was like overcrowded. Yeah. And I remember there being some backlash on like Twitter and, you know, in the news and stuff. And I did feel like Saturday, Sunday, Monday, at least the outer courts, because I was outside on the outer courts watching doubles the whole time. It seemed like they had taken back some of like the grounds passes that they were selling. And I was checking and like they had sold out. Whereas Wednesday and Thursday, you could still buy a grounds pass like that morning.
Yeah, there are some factors. Like I was hearing people speculate also that like the Ash matches weren't competitive, which meant Ash was not full. So all these seats they sold for Ash, Ashicles were out on the grounds instead. And that could definitely be a factor. I don't know what they're, but it was unpleasant. It was just like, it was too much. It was way overcrowded. I had not had that experience before at the US Open and I did not enjoy that. The French Open always has that. French Open is always like shoulder to shoulder, way too crowded. Courts are way too small at the French Open to get seats to almost any match. And I don't recommend it for fans, honestly. I don't think it's a great fan experience, the French Open. I think it was like a sort of kind of person who wants to roam the grounds and go to a lot of outer courts, which is always how I operate. I'm sure it's how you operate too, largely as a doubles guy. Like, French Open is rough. I tell people to go to Rome instead, largely.
Who is Naomi most likely to play doubles and mixed doubles with?
So I believe she was going to play with Kyrgios at Wimbledon in 2022.
Oh, that's right.
And then she got hurt. I think there was talk about that. They shared an agent, which is why she signed him to her agency too. Okay. She co-founded with her agent, Stuart Duguid. She's played some doubles before. She played with a couple of the Japanese girls, I want to say. And she also played with Zhang Shuai. Who's a good doubles player before she was a really successful doubles player. And I played with her a couple times. She wanted to play mixed at United Cup with Nishikori. That was the original plan for the first week of the season. They were going to play mixed. And I think even Nishioka, I think they were going to play and they didn't get in. And it's kind of crazy that they didn't get wild carded, honestly, with Naomi and what a big star she is, that she wanted to play United Cup, I believe, and they didn't get in. That's ridiculous to me, considering how much tennis bends rules. But apparently there's some rule in United Cup as it's written that only the host country can get a wild card for Australia. But Australia was in by merit of DMNR's ranking. So they were already in directly, but they didn't give one to Japan, which just seems kind of like a weird unforced error by them. So I think really it'd be something Olympic or otherwise, like, she didn't play doubles at the Olympics, though, and in Tokyo, she didn't enter doubles. So I don't know if she would. There's also, the thing is, there's also good Japanese doubles players. So there actually are kind of, those spots are kind of taken by competent people in doubles on the Japanese team. So,
it'd be something,
if she was going to do it again, it'd probably be something like a Hopman Cup, United Cup kind of situation where it's with another top singles player and it's kind of part of the gig. But I agree with you, what we were saying off was actually before we started, but like doubles for like mental health is a real thing. Like if for certain players, and then Naomi's not this way. Naomi actually, for her, it stresses her out because she like gets so
worried about the other person.
Worried about the other person, exactly. She's like, I don't want to let them down. I don't feel like I'm comfortable with this. She did not play a lot of doubles growing up. She didn't play junior, so she didn't play doubles. She didn't play any ITF junior tournaments. She's a very rare player who didn't play any ITF juniors. And she and her sister played a bit coming up and they were not good results wise at all. So she doesn't feel comfortable with it and doesn't want to let someone down. But if she could ever sort of learn to be less self-conscious about that and play some and be willing to put herself out there and play some low stakes tennis, that could be helpful, because for her, this was a problem for her in the last couple of years, but because she was playing so little and only playing the biggest tournaments usually, Mm-hmm. Every match felt magnified and everything felt big and high stakes all the time. Whereas some low stakes tennis could actually potentially be pretty good for her. And that could come in the form of doubles potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a conversation with Danielle Collins I had in Charleston where she talked about that. And it seemed like, I don't think she used the word like mental health benefits. I think I kind of attributed that and maybe even said it in our conversation. Yeah. But she talked about how it was just like, it was so much fun playing with her friend Desiree Kravchuk. And I don't think she didn't admit this, and I don't think any player would, but I would imagine for the singles players, it's also, like you said, like low stakes, low pressure, like I don't really need a big result in this doubles draw. But while you're playing, you're still in that competitive mindset and you're focused on that. So it's probably a good way to kind of get out of that pressure of the big singles draws.
Absolutely. No, I definitely do hear singles players admit that for sure, on record and off. I definitely all them do talk about just being like some extra money, you know, if they can win a round or two or even lose first round, it's some money. Get to be in front of a crowd, practice some serves and returns. They often say, especially the guys, like hit some serves, hit some returns. It's good reps in front of a crowd, live, you know, live match action with umpires and ball kids and all that kind of stuff. Like, it's good practice. That's I think what Pegula says too. Pegula uses practice. She often says,
Yeah, Kyrgios has said that too. Anyways, so I want to let you go. Any final requests or comments for the audience? Obviously, the book is on sale.
Oh yeah,
for pre-orders.
Hold it up for all the YouTube viewers. There's the book. It is available. Oh, you there got your go. Tremendous, beautiful. Also, I hope you enjoyed. Hope you get a chance to read it there. It was cool watching on the green screen, just having Naomi's floating head there.
Yeah,
that was cool. I hope you enjoy it. Not a ton of doubles in the book. I actually sent you the one passage that was like a double specific section that got cut. But Naomi didn't play much doubles, and but hopefully people enjoy it. There's a lot of universal tennis stuff there that a lot of tennis fans can relate to. And tennis families, you know, kind of, there's like people trying to get into the sport watching this sort of stuff on, you know, the Florida Academy culture and dealing with like a sibling in the sport, which is their big doubles thing, like how that mm-hmm. can all shake out. So there's some lessons beyond just the stuff people would think of that could be universal. And I'm happy with the book. Glad I got to do it. Proud of what it became. So hope folks can pick up a copy.
Yeah, I'm excited to read it. I've got a long drive tomorrow, so I'll have some time to read it then.
And there will be an audiobook for it. I know you mentioned audiobook. There will be an audiobook eventually, but I don't.
Yeah, I've already pre-ordered the audiobook.
Oh, awesome!
So,
thank you.
So I'm gonna get started on the paper book and probably switch to audio as soon as I have it available.
Tremendous.
So, anyways, thanks Ben a ton for coming on. I appreciate it. To everyone listening, we're going to link to his new book in the show notes and everything else we talked about, including his doubles articles and all of the ways that we're going to fix the ATP and WTA tour in terms of doubles. So, thanks again, Ben. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks well for having me. Appreciate it. Fun.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Doubles Only Podcast. If you're interested in diving deeper into any topics I discuss, I've created double strategy products that allow me to bring you more podcasts and other doubles content without relying on paid ads. I have ebooks and courses that help you make better strategic decisions during matches and become the smartest player on the court. Go to thetennistribe.com/products to learn more. You can also join my free weekly double strategy newsletter that includes video lessons and more on our homepage. If you want to connect, you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, or email me directly, will@thetennistribe.com.